So, first 24 hours of our retreat, not quite 24, we started this morning. This retreat, I kind of assume everyone has a basic working knowledge of Theravada Buddhism. Certain assumptions when I'm talking about this teaching. If you haven't taken the time to study it formally, I suggest you do so. Because Western culture, it's quite often there's a kind of smorgasbord, dilettantish way of dealing with spiritual matters. And so people have kind of shaky intellectual frameworks. They haven't really pondered intellectually Four Noble Truths, Three Characteristics, these kinds of teachings. And if you haven't done that, then you've just sort of, or people who haven't done that have just done a bit of Rumi, a bit of Reiki, a bit of psychotherapy. They're all good things. But to understand any of them, you have to go deeply into them. And so there's a necessity to do your intellectual homework. Otherwise, the mind very easily just goes in, doesn't really have intellectual direction, doesn't have the kind of accuracy of investigation. So my frameworks are always Four Noble Truths, Three Characteristics, Dependent Origination, these kinds of teachings, which then I can consider other things and I can see how does that fit into that framework, which I find very helpful. So it's not rejecting other ways of talking about spiritual life, but it prevents the mind from just being kind of confused intellectually. So intellectual doubt is just one kind of thing. But having said that, there's also a tendency to intellectualize things too much. And so it's one of the downfalls of many forms of Buddhism, I think, when people simply acquire more and more information. Just keep adding to their storehouse of knowledge and keep reading more and more abstruse things and then they're continually just trying to upgrade their opinion and trying to get thinking that by thinking and acquiring more and more knowledge, somehow you'll be free from suffering. But that doesn't work either, because it's simply an opinion, simply a gathering of information. So oddly enough, more study can lead to more doubt. So both take place, I think. A person who hasn't challenged intellectually their mind, why did the Buddha say this? Intellectually getting the framework down. I know my first encounter with this in India as a layman, it was so difficult just getting my head around these different kind of fundamental tenets of Buddhist philosophy. And it was a very good exercise intellectually to do that. So that gives a kind of accuracy of thinking, right thought. But then I also saw, again, the same kind of idea, that if I just kind of read more and more and try to figure out more and more lists and analyses of analyses of analyses, it actually led me to doubt. Just that I'd kind of get more and more, I'd kind of think and I'd read something and then I'd feel I'd understood it, but it was someone else's knowledge, someone else's insight really, if it was even insight. And then I'd come away a few days later, I'd be in doubt again. And then I'd study and I'd be in doubt again. So I think those are the two extremes vis-a-vis intellect. A person who hasn't really sat down and pondered the teaching has just kind of taken on a more kind of inspired way, you know, just reading something that's inspirational or devotional or something like that. That particular way, and the other way is to be, to just take the path of intellectualism. Both, I think, are problematic and limited. So if you don't have a, if you haven't studied Four Noble Truths, and you don't understand where three characteristics fit in that, if you haven't looked at dependent origination, why that's important in terms of the law of karma, then I suggest intellectually you kind of need some homework, do some homework. Because the, say like Four Noble Truths, which talks about suffering and the end of suffering, that always gives you a really very direct way of contemplating your experience. And now the contemplative path takes ideas and language, and then those ideas then focus this capacity to be mindful, this capacity to be aware, and focuses them in the right place. And so the Buddha was not interested in answering all questions. So you find in modern science, it generates so much information now, and just generates more questions. That's interesting. You get more knowledge, but you get more and more questions within the knowledge. So that's not the point of our study. But if we don't have an approach to looking at our experience, we kind of miss the mark, not really know where to look. So sometimes, like, our culture can be very, very, it can constantly, especially kind of liberal, middle class, I think, which is usually, you know, Buddhist is kind of liberal, middle class outfit in this country, people just analyze all the time, or they love to psychologize everything. There's always kind of create a psychological perspective on it, or always analyze it, always be lost in thought. And that can be fruitful at times, but I think it can be a real dead end, because one's trying to realize deeper truths just through thinking. So the kind of strategy that I think the Buddha was presenting was intellectually have a structure that gives you a kind of framework within which you watch your experience, and that framework is designed and given by the Buddha, and he's asking us to look at certain things and look in a certain way for a reason. It's not just abstract knowledge. And the reason is that his realization of an enlightenment showed him a profound possibility in human consciousness. And he said that profound possibility is a human possibility, that we have that possibility, that capacity for enlightenment, and that we need to look at certain things in a certain way to realize that enlightenment. So when you see a Buddha image, when I see a Buddha image, then I'm reminded of that. I'm reminded of someone who realized enlightenment and then said, this is possible, there is a path, this can be done, and these are the suggestions, this is how you could do it, this is how you could do that too. And so that's how you would consider yourself to be a disciple of the Buddha, that you'd actually take that on board seriously, take on those recommendations, and cultivate ways of seeing, ways of looking, ways of contemplating which are in line with that. So we call that right understanding. So right understanding begins with some sense of direction, even if it's just intellectual. But it goes deeper. It goes deeper than that. And for right understanding to operate, you have to be awake. You have to be present. You have to be mindful. So in some sense, mindfulness is also the beginning of right understanding. So you get these two coming together. You get the work of the intellect taking on the teaching, and then you get the work of mindfulness, knowing the way things are. See those two operating together. So I'm saying, today I was just suggesting how in different words around this idea of mindfulness, or the practice of mindfulness. So I was saying watchful, available. Now that brings you into the present moment. That gives you, as I was saying, the platform then to observe the present moment. So that, you could say, is a right view. It's not a right view intellectually, but it's a right understanding. You understand this moment, that this moment is this way. And it feels this way. So right understanding. So right understanding not as an opinion, not as a position, but as a kind of existential presence. Quite often people, when they see like right understanding, they think they have to have the right opinion. We certainly, you need the intellect to direct your attention, but in the way of formal practice, in the way of contemplative vipassana practice, you might say, right understanding is the awake mind. You understand, you know, I'm feeling happy, sad, I like being here, I don't like being here, it's hot, it's cold, whatever's going on, you understand, this is the way I feel right now. Right understanding, right viewpoint, as it were. And then, from that, then you can take these intellectual ideas and apply them to the present moment. So then they're no longer abstract opinions, but they're rather the tools and the avenues, the ways to access the problem. Because the Buddha said there is a problem, and the problem is ignorance. And as long as there's ignorance, and we don't understand ignorance, then we might be very well intentioned and we might try very, very hard, but because we're coming from a misunderstanding, then our intentions and efforts will not be fruitful. They'll lead to frustration. So you have mindfulness, and then you have the suggestion of observation. And the problem that the Buddha suggests is that when we suffer, there's something we don't understand about life. And what we tend to do is, when we suffer, we tend to not observe it, we tend to not investigate it, we tend to react to it, try to get away from it, blame it, do anything but actually understand it. So the problem is a lack of understanding. And you can see that's an aspect of wrong view as well. Wrong understanding, wrong view. And so, as long as there's something in my life which is conflicted, confused, I don't understand, doubt or whatever, that's the very thing I need to make conscious, and that's the thing I need to understand. So we have to make conscious our suffering, make conscious our discontent, make conscious our sense of lack, make conscious our annoyances and fears and self-disparagements and, you know, all the whole nine yards. We have to make conscious, and that's what we're doing when I suggest use these two words: be mindful or watchful, available. Now, if I'm sitting meditation or doing walking meditation, and I'm feeling some, like, let's say I'm doing walking meditation, and like to do walking meditation, you do have to do it. You can't just be looking at the flowers. I noticed one person was walking around looking at the oak tree and kind of looking at the weeds, and then looking, that's not meditation, that's botany. So I suggest, if you're going to do meditation, for goodness sake, do meditation. Don't just play around. If you want to play around, that's all right too. So if you're going to do meditation, what are we doing? We're actually making some determination to stay in the posture. We're making some determination to come to the present moment. We're making some determination to stay on the walking path and be with the walking. So, assuming one's actually meditating, then in that meditative exercise, there comes a point where you know, you feel bored or whatever. So typically you've been sitting maybe an hour, and the last 15 minutes have been painful. Maybe it's hot, discomfort. Maybe not. Maybe you're blissed out. Usually you're not. And you know, you kind of, the bell rings. You feel relieved. Oh, it's nice. Okay, you go for a nice sunny day, and you walk. Then if it's an hour's walk or a 45-minute walk, then half, you know, 15 minutes you're bored. Walking back and forth, and bored. And then, oh, I want to do something else. Look around, maybe go have a cup of tea, sit down. So that's, of course, as Lompo Cha would say, following disaster. Just kind of, whatever the mood is, I'll just follow it. There's no real guts in the practice. There's no real determination. Now, walking back and forth is not a very difficult thing to do. Very easy. But actually staying with each mind moment, that's the difficult thing to do. So after 15 minutes, a person feels disinterested in it. Watchful, available means what? You awaken to that. Oh, I know what that's going on. If not, you get just preoccupied with it. Your mind just gets preoccupied with thinking about something else. So you fantasize. Or you look around or whatever. So there's no real clarity there. So it's, you know, like in a retreat, that's what we're trying to bring up, this kind of sustained clarity, sustained attention on very ordinary things, you know, very, very ordinary things. So then, when within that, if something extraordinary comes up, pain, discomfort, criticism, judgment of someone, now you can see it as an object. Rather than just be the subject who is lost in that, you can witness to it. And if you can witness it, you can begin to contemplate, well, why does that make me suffer? Why can't I just be at peace with this the way it is now? What is it? What's going on? Why do I get preoccupied? What is it that kidnaps my attention? Why can't I just be with the way things are? Now that kind of inquiry is not just intellectual. It's like you're just looking at the difficulties we make around the way things are. And that's the contemplation of dukkha, the understanding of dukkha. So we set up the situation. We set up the retreat. We set up the boundaries, and then within that we give up to that. And that's the best way to do a retreat. The worst way to do a retreat is just to do what you want to do. That's not a retreat. So the best way is a retreat is like the schedule. Really stick with it. Like if I noticed many people just went home at 4:30. I thought the deal was that we were going to stay for 5:30, but there you go. Who am I? But that, you know, that kind of practice where you just take it easy, that hasn't got guts. You know, it doesn't really have any real guts to it. But to actually like practice till 6:30 rather than 5:30, that's more interesting. That's got a bit of fire in it, right? And so the best way to do a retreat is really to give yourself to it. This is the schedule. You know, we sit at this time, we walk at this time, we go right through. Really give yourself to it. Really dedicate yourself to it. And then within that, within those frameworks, or sitting or walking, say, why do I suffer? What is it? Why can't I just be peaceful with this moment? Where's the friction? Where's the resistance? What is it? What is it? Why can't my mind be present? Why is my mind like porridge all the time? Or whatever. What's actually going on? What's actually going on? And that kind of vitality is very much needed in this life. If you don't have that vitality and you just let the mind drift, you know, it doesn't matter. Look at the plants and have a cup of tea. It'll be pleasant, but you won't really get any insight. You won't get any samadhi. You won't get any. You need fire in your belly for this. This is, you know, this PhD program. So contemplate, like, do you really want to do this work? Do you really want to get enlightened? Have you got the determination to really, really stick with it? Really look at your mind, challenge the mind. Now that can sound very macho, you know, and so on. But it's always, you're always trying to find some kind of a balance between sloping off and just being so determined that you know you have a headache and you hate meditation. So the fire of the practice is not to become; it's to sustain awake mind. So, like just in this sitting, I was asking you, where are you now? And if you're sleepy, you won't even hear me. You won't even, you know, you don't adjust your posture. You just keep your eyes closed and stay asleep. That's life in the big city. So I ask you, where are you now? And what happens then? That the mind awakens, hopefully. Venerable, keep your eyes open. Sit up. And when I say that in a sitting, when I say, where are you now? What do you do then? You're probably thinking about something, right? Most people are. If you're not, good. Okay. But if you are, what happens when I say that? Where are you now? What do you do? What happens to your mind? Is it, that's the awake moment. That's the moment you're with life now. So what do you do? How do you sustain that awake mind? That's the challenge. It's not to get something else. It's not even to get rid of thought, but how do you sustain a mind which is present, which is not always going off into endless proliferations and problems and all of that, the mind which stays in the present moment? That's the challenge. Because if you can do that, then you can see how suffering arises, and you can see how we perpetuate suffering. One of the questions that's good to see, how long does your response to life, your reaction to life, echo in your mind? If someone says to you something which is unpleasant, how long does that echo in your mind? If you see someone doing something unpleasant and you feel critical about that, how long does that echo in the mind? How long do you perpetuate that in the mind? You don't need to. Let's say if I see something unpleasant, that hits me, right? That's unpleasant. Now if I'm mindful and I'm present to that, I feel it, it goes through me and it's gone. If I'm not mindful, if I'm not aware, if I'm not present, I pick that comes into me, and I can perpetuate that response for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, because the mind is preoccupied. So what is the mind preoccupied with? So the more we can awaken, the more we can come to the present moment, the more we'll begin to see our preoccupations. So what do we preoccupy ourselves with? Well, quite often future. Right? We just go off to the future. Planning. So a very good thing to contemplate is anticipation. Just take that word. Just take something simple like non-anticipation. Just use simple words like that. I find that really helpful. So you sit down and establish the awake mind. Like really come to the present moment. And then put in words like non-becoming. Non-anticipation, receptive, bring in language like that. That helps to stay in the present moment. Whenever we make effort, quite often our effort is very conjoined with desire, because we want something. We want to get rid of something, or we want to become something, and then we fall asleep, or we get lost in our fantasies, and then we wake up again, and then we try again. But the awake mind, the mind which is open and attentive, is a non-desire mind. It's not a desire mind. And that's the mistake we make. We think that we need to get something in the future, and we need to get rid of something in the past, and we think that there is some kind of an object, some kind of objective experience, which will fulfill us. And the Buddha is saying, that's wrong understanding. We're not seeking an experience, we're seeking the end of desire. That's where we're really free, the end of desire. And you can do that in any moment. You can just wake up. Well, this is the way it feels. So with like things like bodily pain, bodily discomfort, they're actually like I was saying in the afternoon, I said there's something particularly instructive and liberating about a mind which can be with the unpleasant. Some unpleasant situation comes up in your body or in your mind, and you're able to sustain mindfulness around that. What are you doing? You're going against the tendency of desire. Because when you have something unpleasant, desire seeks, so some objective experience is unpleasant, right? Then desire seeks something pleasant. That's the way it works. And that's natural. You have pain, you want to get out of the pain. You feel bored, you want to eat something. You feel angry, you want that person to leave the room. The person, so that's the way it works. Aversion, greed, self-doubt, delusion, these kinds of things. And so the mind, the restless mind or the deluded mind is always seeking objects which are pleasant and trying to annihilate objects which are unpleasant. Huh? So there's this kind of movement. So when you're willing to be with the unpleasant, just to bear with the unpleasant, like the feeling of not getting anywhere, of feeling of boredom, feeling of being annoyed at someone or whatever. You're willing just to be with that, you're going against desire. You're going against the stream of desire. And that takes you to non-desire. That takes you to non-desire. And then in non-desire, you realize what Nibbana is about. Because in non-desire, your mind is free. That's like gratitude is important, compassion is important, kindness is important. These are very, very important states of mind because they are like gratitude. You take gratitude. Gratitude is a state of non-desire, isn't it? Let's say just joking about the food. I mean, the food is terrific. We have the two best cooks in Eastern Ontario here. But as an example, I'm not criticizing the food. Just like having something... a meal which you find unpleasant, let's say it's not carcinogenic or poisonous, it's just unpleasant to your sensibility, and to actually notice the unpleasantness, and it's just unpleasant, goes, and it ceases. So there's the desire for the pleasant, you have the unpleasant, you're not used to it, and you're just with the unpleasant, physically, whatever. Unpleasant feels this way. You're awake to the unpleasant. And that, so the desire comes up to get rid of the unpleasant and get the pleasant. And you no longer just believe in that. You no longer just react to that. And you bear witness to the unpleasant, physical discomfort. Like in your body, physical discomfort is unpleasant. It's supposed to be that way, so you move, but... We all know that if you move on every unpleasant sensation, you just, whatever, you're going to get really restless. So you just watch. Unpleasant feels this way. And that takes you to non-desire. Some aspect of your character. Something you said to someone that you think wasn't right on, or something that you did. You think it was right on. Your mind goes into self-disparagement, right? It's like... I often, today I felt really restless. I don't know what it was, just really restless. I find that unpleasant. I'm supposed to be teaching, I'm supposed to be calm, kind of old monk, lone Paul. And I didn't feel very calm today. So that's unpleasant. It's unpleasant both to my ego image, and it's unpleasant physically. Now, if I just bear with that, unpleasant feels this way. Then eventually it runs its course and it takes me to non-desire. But if I'm not aware, because I want a state of mind which is not restless, I want a state of mind which is peaceful, both for my ego image and for the pleasantness of it, then what do? I go into self-criticism. Oh, here, Dhamma, you're too restless, nya, 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 nya. That's perpetuating. That's preoccupation. I'm not present. I'm not watchful. I'm not available. I'm lost. So I have to bear with the unpleasantness of a certain kind of emotion, which I would rather not have. I'd rather have peacefulness and so on. Like everyone else. But if I just bear with just this sense of restlessness, oh yeah, it feels this way. I mean, I can also stop drinking coffee. But I didn't drink much coffee, so that wasn't it either. Whatever, it's just that way. But it is unpleasant. And I'm pleasant to my self-image, unpleasant physically, you know, as an experience. But so then desire comes up, desire to have not that. And the desire is like an ego desire, so that then runs into self-disparagement, self-criticism, and so on and so forth. But of course, if someone else is restless, and I've criticized myself, then I'll see them and I'll say, you know, I'll be critical to them. And so the mind will be always in critical mode. But if I just look at an unpleasant mood, an unpleasant personality trait, say, let's say I have a personality trait that is, this isn't true, but let's say I'm a really jealous person. I'm not a jealous person. I think somehow I didn't get that one this lifetime. But let's say I've got lots of others. But let's say I have a tendency towards jealousy, right? Someone has, let's say, a young monk has an enlightenment experience, and I just say, rubbish. You're too young to be enlightened. And I just feel totally jealous and intimidated. Now, that's definitely unpleasant, right? And doesn't fit my ego image. So that jealousy comes up into the mind. Now, what's desire? The desire mind doesn't want the jealousy. If I'm a half decent person, if I'm not a half decent person, I believe in the jealousy, and I just chop the guy to pieces, right? So let's say at least I've gotten to the stage of being marginally decent, right? Jealousy comes up into the mind. That's unpleasant. Now, if I remain watchful and available, I'm willing to be available to this unpleasant feeling. And it runs through me, and my mind wants to go to it. And where does my mind want to go? It wants to go to self-disparagement. Oh, he's terrible, 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 terrible person. You're terrible, terrible. But that's just desire functioning. Preoccupation, self, ego, and so on. So then I have to keep coming back. Oh, jealousy feels this way. And that's hard to do because it's such a ugly state of mind. I don't want that. I want mudita. But it's not there. So I can see the principles of mudita maybe, but there I am. I have this more maybe toxic kind of mindset. And if I understand the Four Noble Truths, then I realize it's not the jealousy that's a problem, it's the desire not to have the jealousy. That's the problem. It's not the state of mind which is a problem. It's not the unpleasant which is a problem, it's the desire not to have the unpleasant. That's wisdom. And that's where we misunderstand. So being a good Buddhist and reading about the Brahma-viharas and, you know, that we should have empathetic joy for someone else who's getting enlightened and I feel totally jealous, sour grapes, I want to dump on them, then I don't leave it there. I grasp it with self-view, I take it personally, I run with it, I get preoccupied with it, I hate myself. And then the next time I feel jealous, that comes up, I run with the jealousy for a while, and it's not fair, I've been meditating much longer than him or her, and then I notice that, oh, I shouldn't be thinking that, there's no mindfulness there, it's just preoccupations, yeah, there's no freedom. But at some point, I just wake up and say, oh, jealousy feels very unpleasant, I don't like this, I'm honest about it. But I don't take it and run with it with my ego. I just know this is a mood. This is a form of consciousness which just came up. That's all it is. And then I begin to introduce Dharma language. I introduce the word not me, not mine. And this is how letting go works. When you introduce Dharma language, not me, not mine, you begin to have that correct perspective. When you don't have Dharma language, when you have ego language, then I shouldn't be this way, it's not fair, they shouldn't be that way. There's just this inner warfare, inner argument, there's no freedom there. It's just preoccupation with ego and self. The awake mind begins to see things as changing, not self. Don't touch it, don't go there. This is the language of Dharma, not me, not mine. So that is a kind of very practical way to use the intellectual structure that the Buddha suggested is the way things are. And then to employ that in the way your mind works. So that's my suggestion. And you know, as the retreat progresses, any sense of self that arises with bodily, mental, emotional conditions, don't go there. Just say, not me, not mine. So if you have some, I mean, you can use uncertainty or anatta, you can use dukkha, you know, the three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta. You use all three actually all the time. So if you feel you've got this incredible project that you want to fantasize about, that's just greed, you're bored. That's all it is. So just say uncertain. Uncertain, you know, because the greed mind will create this fantastic thing which you're going to do in the future and it's going to be really fun. That's what greed does. Just say uncertain. Or say not me, not mine. Just keep Dharma language coming into the moment. And what that does, it awakens your mind. It brings you back to availability, watchfulness. If you, let's say, you're fantasizing about something or you're annoyed at something, just say not me, not mine. And come back to that witnessing posture. Not me, not mine. You get into self-disparagement about something. Not me, not mine. Don't claim it, don't own it, don't be it. Be aware, be the awareness, be the awareness. That's where your freedom lies. Now that, you have to really do that a lot. Because delusion delusion is a high volume thing. It just kind of crowds into your mind and makes it all believable. That's why it's so deluded. And the more you can bring in Dharma language, this is changing. This is uncertain. Not me, not mine. What does that do? It gives you the distance. And then things change. So we're not looking for an object. We're not looking for an experience. We're understanding that peace lies in non-desire. Desire looks for experiences and rejects experiences. Desire functions from memory. Someone tells you something about Buddhism, about some peaceful state of mind, or you've had some experience, and then you desire that. You desire that experience. You have some nasty bit of toxic karma coming into consciousness. I don't want that. That's ugly. I don't want that. I don't want that. But not me, not mine. And then you have to be very resolved and patient. You have to allow these things to go through you. Let them be conscious. Let them go through you. It's okay. They won't hurt you. Not me, not mine. And then they run their course. And they run, where they run, they all take you to non-desire. They all take you to the silence and peace of the mind. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.